And please correct me if I'm wrong in any way, that everyone here is at least moderately familiar with some very, very basic features of Shechita, so I'll go through them relatively quickly. Stop me if you need any clarification or if anything is not so understood. These halachot used to be standard and required in any bechina for any kind of rabbanut. In other words, you wouldn't get the most basic of smicha without knowing at very least what makes an animal kosher or treif, how to check. As Rav Shechter himself used to say, 9 out of 10 shelot that a rab would get Erev Shabbat, 9 of them would be, can you tell me if this chicken is kosher, if it's a nevela? And the other 1 out of 10, probably something in Tarat HaMishpacha or in some other area of kashrut. So the Rabbanut in Eretz Yisrael, if it's not a sign of the times, I don't know what is, recently struck Shechita from the mandatory, the required topics that you have to take bechinas on. This is all of maybe 7 or 8 years ago. There are quite a number of slaughterhouses in Israel, but it's no longer expected that a Rav Ir, Rav Shchuna, or Rav Moshav would actually be required to paskin any of it. Which is a shame, but it is what it is. So, we have Halachah Moshe Mi-Sinai, 5 nevelot, which is a classic example of the Torah teaching us something by way of negative information, negative example. We don't know what makes an animal kasher. What we do know is what makes it a nevela. So if you manage to do shechita without botching any one of these 5 possibilities, your shechita is kosher, and if not, then it's not. So what are the 5 things you have to be careful about? It's a great zone for us. Wonderful siman that came out of Rotzot Ashkenaz is Shohad Rab. Great siman, right? Shohad Rab. Shohad lo tikach. Ki ha-shohad ya'avar anecha chamiya salech divrei tzadikim. So, the shin here stands for Shehiyah. Right? What does lishchot mean in Hebrew? Lishchot is to pause or to wait. So I didn't know, but now I do, that the shechita has to be done, what, in one fell swoop? Nonsense. I could stand there the whole day going back and forth. The Gemara says, no such thing. That wouldn't be a shehiyah. I wouldn't be violating anything. I have as long as I'm in the process of making reciprocal motions back and forth, regardless of how long or short the knife is. It could take a day. It could take longer. Want me to prove it to you? I'll prove it to you. You have a famous mission of Masechet Yoma, where the Mishnah said the Kohen Gadol would begin the shechita of the par and hand it off to somebody else. What happened to Shehiyah? What happened to stopping? So for a second or two, thank you. I woke up with a headache. It's not your fault. So Shehiyah, how long can you wait? What's the halachic standard for how long you can wait in order for the animal to actually be considered a kosher shechita? You're going to find out in very, very little time that many, many of the halachot that we have just about everywhere in the Shas, we actually learned from the very first parak of Masechet Chulin, which is exploding with halachic information, with ne'emanut, who we consider to be from, not from, hashgacha, mashgiach, who's a baki, who's not a baki, shote, we'll talk about that in a second too. So the only place in the Torah we actually have an indication of time and how time can affect the mitzvah in terms of you have this amount of time that you can break before you actually ruined it is from Shechita. You ever seen the Mishnah Berurah? He talks about how long can you wait if you fell asleep or if you had to stop because of a bad smell in the middle of Kriyat Shema. He says, how long can you wait? You can wait as long as it would take you to start and finish a whole Kriyat Shema. He tells the same thing in Barakat HaMadu. Where do we learn this from? From Shechita. How long do I have? The Mishnah says, you can take the animal, right? As long as it takes me to pick up an animal, knock it down, and shecht, and we're talking about 2 simanim, we'll talk about that in a second too, I have to cut the trachea and the esophagus, and in the case of animals, in that particular order, trachea is on the outside, the esophagus is on the inside. If I could have performed a whole other shechita of an entirely other animal, a separate entity, a separate being, then my shechita is no good if I haven't been consecutively reciprocating, back and forth, going what we call holacha v'hava'ah. So I paused for as long as it takes to shecht another animal. How long it takes to shecht another animal? Okay, the Gemara doesn't even bother, since the Mishnah is just there and deal with it. So
the Ashkenazim, and this is typical of Ashkenazi Psak. When you're in a suffix, just be really machmir and ignore the Mishnah if it says otherwise. So the Rama writes, "Nu, we have a chashash. What's the chashash? It takes me however long to shecht an animal is one thing. What if I gave a lamb to Og Melech HaBashan? Literally, the Rama says this. Gave a lamb to Og Melech HaBashan, and he could shecht it in like a second because he's Og Melech HaBashan and he's awesome. And that would leave us a situation in which I have a suffix, maybe it's relative to how long it takes you or me or him to shecht. Therefore, any small shahiyah and the minig is to be matrif, because this is the definition of nevela. These five halachot of shechita, these are all the five possibilities of creating a nevela. There's another one we'll talk about in a second too. So, in classic and beautiful form of Yosef Tapah, probably one of the greatest Temani Talmidei Chachamim that came to Israel after the founding of the state. If Chazal had such a concern, the Mishnah would have said so, and it didn't. The Mishnah was given to Am Yisrael. We're human beings. None of us is Og Melech HaBashan. And when Chazal gave us a barometer, they gave us a test, they gave us something that just about anybody could do. That's the purpose of the Mishnah, teach people halacha. So we're not Chashish Og Melech HaBashan. Nonetheless, even the Sefaradim tried to put limits on this. You have two competing traditions. You won't find this in Sfarim. This is from, this is literally Torah Shebaal Peh. About the Shochatim. We had pretty much Yemen and North Africa. The two competing Masorot are, they would give you approximately Asara Ragaim, and they would count, and they weren't from New York. So Aleph, Bet, Imal, Dalet. Hey, Wow, Zain, Chet, Tet, Yod. Give you 10 seconds. Try to shecht an animal in 10 seconds. That's actually still pretty firm, because it takes time. They're trying to run away from you. We assume that maybe it's tied up. We still have to pick it up, knock it down. The knives were nowhere near as sharp as they are today. We'll talk about that in a second, too. So they give you approximately 10 seconds. That's still pretty strict, because it can take a lot longer than that. And you're talking, again, not about the shechita itself. We're talking about actually picking it up, knocking it down, and performing a kosher shechita. The other masoret, very interesting, would actually peg this to the Mishnah itself, give you approximately 7 seconds. And the minhag was to use the words of the Mishnah itself. Your mom should take the Mishnah like super literally. So, Shahat Me'at, Washaha Me'at, Wachazar Washahat Me'at. Started shechting a little bit, you stopped shechting a little bit, and you started shechting a little bit again. So, the Mishnah says, if you can be Mitzaref, all of these Shehiot, and it would take you, as long as it would take you to pick up, knock down, and shecht another animal, that's how we define a Shehiot. So, you would have successfully created a Nevela. And so, as Rav Giat, Morev Ribi, used to say, this is Torah Shabbat. Takes me a little bit longer, you a little bit less. The Mishnah was not giving you microseconds to work with. At the end of the day, Chazal said what they said, and this is still halacha lemaase. Large slaughterhouses today, the minhag by Achinu Ashkazim is to be machmirim when it comes to goats and lambs. Even the Rama admits that even Og Melech HaBashan would have a little bit of a hard time knocking down a cow. So there he gives you shehiyah mo'etet. Everyone holds the chatzilah is okay. Not easy to shecht cattle. So even there, he gives you a bit of breathing room. That's the shin for shehiyah, the chet, and this one is tricky. Chalada, right? Chalada. Modern Hebrew, we hold by chalada, meaning rust, which is interesting. In the language of the Mishnah, a bit of a discussion amongst the others. In the language of the Mishnah, chalada basically means burying or piercing. So what happens if I take a knife that has a point? I take an arrow or a spear, and instead of shechting from the outside in, I spear between the simanim, or I pierce the skin and cut down, or I go behind the simanim and creep my way back up and out. This would be considered a harada. There is no logical reason why we should arrive at the conclusion this is a nevela. Were the Torah not to tell us so? No compelling evidence. If it weren't for halacha Moshe Sinai, I wouldn't know to include this. Matter of fact, the Gemara says, Masechet Chulin, you'd be surprised, learn it. I'm a big advocate of Bekiut. There's lots and lots of Amei Haaretz out there, even those who have Smicha. It's okay. You can admit it. Learn Masechet Chulin. You will be shocked by what Chazal ate and by how Shechita was sometimes done. The Gemara says, David HaMelech would take arrows and fire them at his lambs, and he would eat from it. So probably it was a somewhat broad arrowhead, but he would do this. It's not even the hardest question of all is Chalada. How did you do this without piercing the neck? I mean, it didn't sound like Chazal were impressed because he would shoot them from 2 inches away. But it's possible. Threw a knife and it bounced off a wall and came back the other way. Okay, there we go. So anyway, Nav Shehiyah, we have Halada. I don't recommend either one. Dalet is for Dirasa. Dirasa. It doesn't appear with the Yud until the Rishonim. So Dirasa is how it looks like written in the language of the Mishnah. So Lidros. Right? Lidros. Well, Lidros in Hebrew is to crush or to press on something, often associated with defeat, not necessarily. So Dirasa would be the language of the Gemara is Mechatech Kitznon. Someone who's cutting something like radish, where radish, there's no sense in going back and forth. It's a hard, kind of stiff vegetable. You just press, you chop, you go straight down, and it splits automatically. Potatoes cut the same way. You don't need a serrated knife. You just press, and they open up. So, drasa, you would have created a nevela by pressing. In other words, it's not the blade of the knife that's doing the work. It's the force, the pressure applied. Think the guillotine in France. Just a sharp object coming down with speed, and it creates a separation, but it doesn't actually slice or sever in the way that a sharpened blade would when you're pulling back and forth. Get a little bit more detail on that too in just a bit. Doresh, this one is tricky because it's cute for the siman, but we have to bend a little bit. It's actually for hagrama. Hagrama. Okay, so hagrama lehagrim, also no compelling etymology to the meaning that we associate with the word, but lehagrim is to sheft out of place. There is what's called mekomo shechita. We'll define it. Mekomo shechita is in the kane, in the trachea, right under what we call, there's a shipui kova. So the trachea looks like this. It's basically a tube, kind of like a hose, and it has these cartilaginous rings that ribs that give it stability, so it wouldn't kink like a garden hose. When you want to stop a garden hose, you can fold it in half, prevent the water from flowing. So if every time you bent your head in a certain direction, or if an animal were to bend down to eat, it would choke. Life would be very short. It's short enough as it is. So the trachea has these reinforcements that keep it stiff and round, no matter how you pull or push or twist it. Up here. And here we're already looking at what's effectively the jaw. Up here you have this shipui kova. It looks kind of like the brim of a hat, shipui kova, right? Because all Chazar wore the black Hamburg hats. Naturally, shipui kova, the hats they wore back then, had a tilt on them. Think like a fez hat, the Moroccan one. So it looks like this. Here is where you have what's called these torechite, these two things that look like grains of wheat. They're actually the vocal cords. And you can sheft anywhere below that. So that's the upper limit of shechita is going to be over here. The lower limit is going to be ad kanaf shel re'a, until the point at which the uppermost right minor lobe of the lungs, give me a minute with the lungs, we'll talk about that too. Basically up until the uppermost portion of the most anterior portion of the lungs, when the animal's on all fours, the one that's closest to the head, when it's inflated, right? Which is a nice way of saying you have up until the clavicle, because the lungs don't push through the clavicle. Everything pretty much comes to an end over there, and the simanim pop out. So that only be possible if you're shefting with a chisel. And you can, or a razor blade. True story, I can't help myself. Rav Eliyahu Ben Chaim, if you haven't met him, please do. He is mamash, sharper than a razor in Bikiyut, in the Shas, Bavli Yerushalmi, and Arbach HaKadosh Shel Haruch. I've asked him questions in all Arbach HaKadosh Shel Haruch. I can attest to it. Rav Ben Chaim was in the army in 1967, when they had come almost as far as Cairo in Egypt. And the soldiers were hungry. They didn't realize, just like they went further east, almost to Damascus, and they didn't realize how fast it was going to go. The Egyptians were afraid, and they folded very quickly. They had no air force anymore, and soldiers came in. So they ended up reaching the outskirts of the city. They were told not to actually, invade or conquer the city. And some of the soldiers got hungry, and this was in a time where, even if they weren't so super firm, a lot of their parents were still, relatively religious. Eating kosher, what do we do? So they found a place where there was a guy who was raising pigeons, very popular meat in North Africa, pigeon. And they found a soldier who shaved with a blade. So Ben Chaim said, no, we can easily be in Zakim et Arabim. Just because it's a difficult situation, we're soldiers at war, doesn't mean we have to eat in the middle. So he checked the razor, found that it was actually smooth enough, no pegimot, and shefted a bunch of pigeons for the guys to eat from. So you can chef with a razor, you can chef with a chisel. It's something relatively small, you just have to be careful to be going back and forth and not to press. And there the trick would again, especially on birds, you have to be careful not to shift too high up in the neck. It's actually a little bit, be like here, like under the bottom of the jaw is where the shipui kova actually, I think it's more anatomically correct. That's what it would look like. So you can technically, if you pull the head back, you would be able to shech too high, and you'd have ruined the shechita. And then you have here until the end of the clavicle, which is where the lungs inflate to, the point they inflate to when the animal's breathing in. So that gives you from here till here. In terms of the weshet, which is the other siman, that's the esophagus, Chazal said the upper limit of it is basically ad makom shemit koetz. You can shecht as high up as you want, as long as it snaps. It's under tension, the trachea, because it's a muscle. It has to be. It's got to force the food down. So it won't, if you shecht too high, it'll just stay there, because it's anchored into the soft tissue around it. If you shecht just under that, it's also more or less the same place. Just as you get below the tongue, it's already going to, the roots of the tongue, that is, it'll already just snap back. And that's the upper limit of it. So the trachea we're going to put over here. As it relates to the tongue,
the esophagus.
Sorry, thank you. And how far down can you go? So once again, to prove to you, Chazal did shecht with very small implements that are easier to sharpen. You can go as far as the beginning of what they call these little finger-like projections into. Sorry, didn't. These little finger-like projections that begin where the esophagus runs right into the stomach. So these animals have four-chambered stomach. Right over here is where you have these little, they look like little hairs, but they're visible, they're very visible. So you can shecht up until that point. Then you've no longer shecht, then it's not the esophagus anymore, it's only the beginning of the stomach. That creates problems. So the definition of hagoma would be shechting too high, shechting too low. Simple enough, but it's defined that way. And the last of the five nevirot would be ekur, right? Ekur. Here we have a very interesting machloket amongst the Rishonim. We know that it's a surah to be ma'akir. We don't know what it means. So we have the classic understanding of ekur is shefting with a knife that has a peginah. And this would be what you're violating by not shefting with a knife that's smooth. Not a function necessarily of how sharp the knife is. It's a function of how smooth it is. If your knife is serrated, in other words, it has teeth, it has some kind of an indentation, it was chipped or dented or scratched, so serrations don't cut, they tear. They tear. So if you tear at the simanim and rip them with your hands or something else, a blunt instrument or a partially sharp instrument, you haven't actually sliced them open, you've effectively ripped them. And that would be, you'd be guilty of, according to some of the Rishonim, guilty of ikur. There's another opinion. The Rambam explains ikur would be, that was Rashi. The Rambam holds that ikur would be taking the simanim and being ma'akir, right? Ikar in Hebrew means what?
Rip out.
No, ikar, the word ikar in Hebrew. Shoshan sar ikarim. Ikar means a root. Literal definition is a root. We use it figuratively to mean principles. But the ikar is a root. So la'akur literally means to uproot, to pull something out by the roots. So, if I pull the simanim off of their moorings, right? I pull them, I destroy the soft tissue connections that hold them together, then basically, the Rambam says, it's a very interesting terush, he says, if you pull the simanim out of mekom ha-shechita, so instead of the front and center of the throat, I pull the simanim to the side or behind the head, he says, this is the only way for you to understand this is to do it. Take an animal, tear at simanim, and then you can figure what it looks like when your simanim are dislocated. In other words, where they don't revert back to their original position. So I pulled them so hard, so now it's not even considered shechita because the simanim are no longer rooted where they're supposed to be, no longer held in place. And it's now impossible, even if with a perfect knife and a kavanot arizal, I still can't effectuate a kosher shechita because simanim have been torn out of place and won't revert back to it. Or he says, even if you didn't tear them out of place, you just stretch them a lot without tearing them, and then shefted back on the side of the neck or in the back. Probably much easier to do with birds that have longer necks and more flexible simanim than with animals. But by all means, feel free to try and do prove me wrong. The only other possibility when it comes to making a nevelah, anybody want to guess? You haven't seen this yet? That's it. Shechitat akum. Right? Obdeko chovim mozarot.
It's a very common misconception, unfortunately, amongst ignorant people in this generation, both Ashkenazim and Sephardim, who seem to believe that the Muslims perform the same shechita that we do. Muslim shechita is an avela for about 10 reasons, and there can only be 6, so that's really good. They don't check their knives, so it's quite possible, in fact, probable, that they're shechting knives that have pigimot. Why? Because they shech like bandits, like absolute pirates. You have to come to the slaughter house to appreciate this. Don't say it there, but they'll take the knife and mamish cut until they hit bone, because it makes you feel good to cut heads off. And you've seen this. That's right. They do this to people, so why would they have any more rahmanut than their animals? Right, animals too. Right. So they, they're consistent. The other thing is that you'll see that most of the time when they take animals, because they have no technique of shechita, they'll basically shaft as close as they can to the base of the jaw, because when you pull the animal's head back, that's where the skin is the most tense, and this is the really hard part about shechita. If any of you would eventually like to learn, be it birds or behemoth, that the tricky thing with shechita is just keeping some tissue tense, keeping it taut, so that it cuts really easily, right? Take a shirt and try to cut it with a knife. You know, it won't go anywhere. You won't really do anything. If you hold it tight, it's much easier to cut. Why is that? Because as long as these fibers can move and jiggle and get away from you, they will, because they don't want to be cut. So this is what happens. They basically shecht right into the shipui kova, each and every time, without mistake. So they're shechting in the wrong place. They're shechting with a knife that's never been checked. All they care about is that the knife is a little bit... How sharp does it have to be? Sharp enough to, like, catch your fingernail. It's not very sharp. They cut to the bone, they chop, and it doesn't necessarily have to be so much of a reciprocal motion as much as just the knife caused the animal to die, so it's very possible that they're doing much more of a drasa than we would let any shochet get away with. And I've seen them do chalala too. A lot of Muslims shecht with sharp knives, and they just stab it into the throat, through the throat, behind it, and care. They're not very... It is what it is, you have to see it to believe it. So, shechita of a non-Jew, on top of everything else, would be an avela nonetheless. Nothing you can do to change that. Once the goy did the shechita, there's no bringing the animal back to a state of kashrut. Once the animal has been shechted, look in the Bet Yosef, Siman Lamed Hey, it's a very interesting discussion. We have 18 terefot, again, halachal Moshe Misinai, right? Shmasal terefot, that's the first mission of this, the third chapter of Chulin. So, these terefot also halachal Moshe Misinai. There is a debate in the Gemara, not perfectly resolved, as to whether or not terefa haya shenemasar chodesh. Is it possible for a... Is it terefa? And here, by the way, please, some disambiguation is in order. Just like the word mitzvah in Yiddish doesn't mean mitzvah in Hebrew. You know, like you're doing a mitzvah by giving tzedakah to someone who doesn't deserve it, things like that. Macha mitzvah, but not in a literal technical tariag sense, just you're doing something nice. So trefa is one of these words that's been hijacked and taken out of context. So a trefa is a very specific halachic status for something, right? Literally, all it means is that this animal had some kind of issue, some kind of a problem, that chazal, that was again, halachal Moshe Misinai, the Torah tells us, and I don't know what a trefa means. If it weren't for the Torah describing this, there's no way we could have guessed. So, these 18 different terefot are all pretty unanimously life-threatening situations. The question is only what's the immediacy of the threat to life. If the animal could be sustained naturally or artificially, would it count, would it not? They're all treif at the end of the day. That's more of an academic discussion. Literally treif, not figuratively, Yiddishly treif. So when it comes to the terefot, we have niqav kurum amoah. So... the meningeal membrane that's around the brain. I'll show you this in the slaughterhouse. Yes, if that membrane is pierced, you've got some serious problems. The same goes for any part of the digestive tract. And so, although they read a separate terefot, that's the entirety of the esophagus, any one of the four stomachs, large or small intestine. It's all the same. One tiny hole, and you can basically bet on the animal's imminent death. Septicemic shock. Once food matter leaves, it's going to create an abscess. It's gonna, it'll fester with bacteria, and the animal will die. Yeah. Either at the hands of animals, at the hands of other animals of the same species, or disease, illness. We'll talk about that. The lungs, I'll focus on a little bit more. It could be an accident. It could be they were out drinking. It doesn't really matter. If it was born this way, it would still be a treifa. And for that matter, and this is a very important distinction, kirum sha'ala mehamat makah eno kirum. Which is Chazal's way of saying that scar tissue doesn't count, is not considered intact tissue. So if I know for a fact that one of the stomachs was ever pierced, even if it's scarred over and the animal survived, and they can, it would still be a treifa for the rest of its life. Its milk would be asur, for example. It's not very commonly done. It's not very commonly done. But if you have a very productive dairy cow, or if you change the feed, sometimes it creates bloat. And their stomachs, because their digestion is overwhelmingly bacterial, I mean a little bit enzymatic, but overwhelmingly bacterial, the bacterial profile of the stomach is going to change to adjust based on what it is that they're eating, if it's fresh grass or hay or silage or grains. Especially alfalfa is extremely gassy. It's very nutritive, but it's extremely gassy. So the good advice that you'd get, especially because most of these farmers are way out in the middle of nowhere and veterinarians have to come from hours away, you have a cow that you look like is suffering from bloat and it could well cause the entire stomach to rupture, you just lance it. Just pierce the stomach towards the top, you know, as high up as you can reach it without going into the lungs. Relieve the pressure. Treat the wound like you would treat anything else. Don't feed it too much. And there's a good chance, you know, 80-90% chance that it'll survive. That would make it a treifa on the spot, and it would never lose that status. Nothing you could do to it could cause that status to change. So it's not commonly done. Don't let people hype up the need for hashgacha on dairy farms. It's no one's going to make a living stabbing cows and watching if they survive or not, but it's a more desirable alternative than what would probably be a more serious situation. You can de-escalate the situation by doing that. These treifot are not so common. If the majority of the spinal cord is severed, if the Achilles tendon is severed in its entirety, some of it is related to gidim, to different functions, or a pierced lung is one of them, right?
How is Achilles tendon life-threatening?
Which is very interesting. It's not an inherent threat to life in the sense that if you were to manually feed this animal, it could live indefinitely. Probably not, though. If it can't walk, it'll eventually, it will eventually die. It'll get weak. Exercise is just part of the animal's daily routine. If it doesn't move anywhere and go anywhere, it'll get anemic, it'll get weak, and eventually die. If it had to fend for itself and get its own food, it wouldn't last a day. But the fact that we can keep it alive artificially doesn't mean that it wouldn't eventually, you know, succumb to something. But it's a mechanical failure. It's not a critical systems failure, so to speak. Interesting question, though. It's true. Right, so we don't view the skin as it is essential to life. It is pretty crucial, but there's no chance that an animal would survive that. Animals do survive pretty tough situations, though. It could be that it lost a chunk of the skin. If it's a meot and not the robe, people survive burns and, you know, accidents too. But it's a temporary thing. It would scar over, and that's not one of those crucial membranes that needs to be intact from the day it was born till the day it's shechted, the day it dies. And interestingly enough, a pierced trachea does not appear. Here's something really interesting that you're not going to see in this farm. The Shulchan Aruch talks about the Shehiyah when it comes to behemot, right? So you would be tempted to say, behemah daka, how long do you have to stop? I sneezed, I got an allergy attack, hay fever, dropped the knife, picked it up, whatever. How long can I wait? So he said, okay, you know, as long as it would take you to shecht on the animal, let's assume 7-10 seconds, we'll be sfardim for a minute. Behemah gasa, obviously it takes longer. Right? We're a little bit skittish about it because really there's no limit to that. So we would just as soon try to abide by the 7-10 second rule. What's the deal with a shehiyah by a bird? Let me give you an introduction to this. How many simanim do we need to shecht in order to make a mammal kosher? Two simanim. Actually, rov shnayim, it's only the majority of both simanim. So 51% of trachea and esophagus, and the thing is kosher. The Rema wants the chatchila a rov nikar. He's certainly not mahmir, and if said nirobe, if it's your only animal, you're out on a farm somewhere, that's not an industrial slaughterhouse.
Sorry, 51% of what?
Of the trachea and the esophagus.
Need to be...
Both need to be shechted. Oh, at least the majority of both need to be shechted. It's a rov pashut. Rov pashut. The mission doesn't require rov nikar, and here's the Gemara. How many simanim do I have to shecht in a bird? Rov siman echad. The rif is relatively unique in the sense that he wants you the chachila to shecht both. Right? Just because you never know, they're small. Okay, fine. But still, He wants you to shecht rov siman echad. He holds is technically chatchila, but the chatchila should be aiming for both. Certainly no problem with it, but he still calls shechita me'ula if you manage to nail both of the simanim. I told you before the trachea is in front of the esophagus, right? How could I do a shehiya on a bird? Very interesting question. The Shulchan Aruch says the shehiya on a bird, how long is it? Same amount of time as a behemah daka. Really? I mean, if the bird flies away and I have to go chase it, 7-10 seconds probably wouldn't even be enough. What's the kesher between the two? The Mishnah reads that only if rov hakaneh was severed, and it could be the animal's attacked by a weasel, by a bird of prey, an eagle, a hawk, a falcon, a kite, a harrier, an owl, etc. Could be that it was bitten in the throat. If the majority of the trachea was severed, the animal's not going to survive. This we consider a trefa. I mean, regardless of how old, by trefa chayash nemasar chodesh. If the minority of the trachea was torn, then it's not considered a trefa, right? So, in my slaughterhouse scenario, I'm holding a goose, and I shecht, and I got the minority, not the majority, the minority of the trachea. Okay? What's the status of the bird if I take the knife away? If I leave it like this, and it dies, it didn't die from a kosher shechita, I didn't cut the majority. But if I stopped and I started, okay, what I actually have created in nevela, by the time the animal is already kosher. You follow what I'm saying? There's nothing wrong with it if I only cut the minority of the kaneh. In fact, if I went and found a bird that someone had started shefting and didn't finish, the Ramah doesn't like it, Ikar Hadin, Shulchan Aruch holds, fine, no problem. It has a damaged trachea, I can go shecht it after him, because the animal could theoretically survive this. And they do. You ever seen people that have those smokers? Tracheotomy? They just pierce a hole lower in the trachea if it's obstructed somewhere higher up. So it's possible that an animal survives this, and Chazal knew it. So as long as it's 30-40%, it's not a big deal. I tap it one more time with the knife. Oh, we hit 51%. Now it's kosher. So is it possible there is such a thing as a shehiyah on a bird? Good question. From the Rambam, it doesn't sound like there is such a thing. Shulchan Aruch says, okay, the Rambam wants an instant, a second, you did a shehiyah. Because birds are small and they shecht fast, fine. The Rambam, it seems like he's following the literal language of the Mishnah. If you only cut the minority of the kaneh, you didn't do anything. And by the time you hit the majority of it, even if you paused and didn't do the rest of the veshet, you don't need it because you're done. So it's a good question. Anyway, halacha lemaisa, the Shulchan Aruch holds by the same shehiyah as the behemah daka, probably because he holds meikar hadin the same way and he wants to give you a little bit more of siyag. And the Rambam holds by kerega when it comes to a bird. Yeah. It's a good question. From a technical standpoint, it's going to be hard for you to ascertain exactly how much was cut until you can do what we would call politely a post-mortem investigation. If you were to ask me, I would just assume shecht somewhere else and see, ascertain the status, verify the status after the fact, after the shechita. But if someone started and without having removed his knife, you know, realized that he only cut a little and not a lot, just keep on going. It's tam chaval to stop. So, anyway. The most problematic of all of these trefot, most animals don't have a broken spine, most of them don't have broken vertebrae, most of them do not have a severed Achilles tendon, and most of them don't have meningitis or a pierced pericardium or a pierced heart. The one that really does appear the most, well, actually a pierced veshet, that was a big story by foie gras. Are you familiar with this? Foie gras in French, it means fat liver.
Yes.
So how do you make a liver fat? You feed the birds grains, right? Which is terrible, because Chazal only did this for like 2,000 years before the animal rights activist, environmentalist, PETA, gay lesbian rights establishment got off the ground. So gay marriage is legal, but foie gras is not. Cedar, avanti. What happens with foie gras is that when you feed geese, especially grains, because grains are caloric, you have to see pictures of this. If you actually go to a farm where they do this, a normal farm, not like a mamish industrial place, the geese run up to the farmer who comes in with a bucket of grains, even if they're being stuffed. I mean, they know that it's food and they enjoy it. It's not, stuffing process itself not so pleasant, but it's not like they're all dying to die. They come, they eat, and they get fatty livers. So the liver goes from being a dark brown, almost purplish color, and there's variation even in healthy animals. The liver goes to being kind of white, and it becomes effectively kind of fatty looking. And so what you would do, by us it's a little bit tricky because you still have to broil it, okay? We can't be machshir the liver with melicha. So you do have to somehow broil it. We'll talk about that maybe some other time, not in the context of Shechita. But at the end of the day, it happens to make a fantastic pate. I mean, it's basically fleshig butter. It's really, really good. Recommend it to all my best friends. It's just that the only chashash, the only halachic discussion there ever was about this, and I'm telling you again, by the way, Tarangolim Mefutamim, sound familiar? Anybody ever sing on Shabbos? And this pitum is what? Pitum HaKetoret? They were force-feeding their chickens, making them fatty. Why? Because fat tastes good. Come on. That's, everybody knows this, right? Chatat Shemena. Rabbi Lazar on the ground. Okay, fine. Anyway, the Mishnah and Shabbat. So people used to force-feed their animals, right? Agalim Yitro is mentioned as being Mefatem Agalim Navadazara. Not pestering them. Ranan Ro'e Agalim Navadazara. He would force-feed them grains to make them fatty. Because come on. Really, even a Vodazara, it's got to be fatty and taste good. So, at any rate, it was done historically for thousands and thousands of years. If you look it up, there are some food historians that hold this process dates back as far as Egypt. That in Mitzrayim this was done. In fact, there are food historians that credit the Jews, the Italian Jews, as having brought this minhag with them to Italy, from which it spread to the rest of Europe. I have a really cool catalog I can show you, if I remember to bring it with me. But some very famous traditional specialties that only Jews produced in Italy, where all the goyim were raising two pigs every year, at very least, if you didn't have a whole farm. One little piggy went to market, and that was a one-way ticket, but that's what paid basically for the next two piglets you buy for the next year, and they'd make all their sausages and hams out of the other one. The Jews didn't raise pigs, they raised geese. And they made some fascinating, really delicious things out of geese, but the goose and the Jews in Italy date back as far as we have written records of them, which is really far back. Like Mishnah far back, the Chachamim and Romi, that far back. So the claim, I think Wikipedia holds this way, that the Jews brought this practice of force-feeding the geese with them from Egypt when they left. Anyway, we have, the only shadow there would be, if you're force-feeding the geese, how can you know that the Weshet wasn't torn in any particular place? And the answer is almost in the question. Had I torn the Weshet, the animal probably would have died by the next day. Maybe two. You know, chances are, if it had a torn or a pierced veshet, it just wouldn't have survived. So we have to assume the fact that it's not dead is good proof that it's alive, and we'll take that and run with it. But there's a famous story by the Chassidim and Menachim, the time of the Chatam Sofer, that there's a discussion as to whether or not they should be matter this, and the Chassidim wanted to aser it. Just nothing to do with the animal rights. It was all about the veshet and whether or not it's really kosher or not. And so, famously, they use the story of Zayat HaDishmai, we're learning Torah and doing Lishma, that I forget the Chassidish Rebbe in question, but he told us, tell me them, go, get a bunch of geese, force feed them the way they do, and let's see how they do. And less than a year, they all died. And by the Chatam Sefer's Kehila, all the geese that they force fed were alive and happy and healthy, and the Sheikh didn't eat them. So they said, okay, so Chassidim holds us, so they hold some much term. But the only way you could check this would be by, after the Shechita, taking the Veshet out, filling it up a little bit of water, playing with it like a water balloon, and see, there's no holes, and it works, it's fine, it's okay. And even this is not necessary. The fact that it's alive and didn't have any problems, we assume you don't really need to check. That brings us to the re'ah, to the lungs. Simon Lamed Hey, you'll see in the Yoredeah, Moran has a discussion, and he says, really, he holds like Rashi? Me'ikar hadin, an animal is healthy, right? Behema b'chayeha b'chizkat kashrut omedet ad shi wadarecha b'meni terefa. As long as the animal's alive, remember this, commit it to memory, it's not dead. And if it's not dead, it's probably not treif. How do you know that it's not treif? Because it's not dead. The logic isn't necessarily circular. If a treifa means it's going to die very soon, if it looks really sick, you'll check. So Rashi holds that the only thing that Chazal checked systematically, and he holds this as kind of, let's say, midrabanan. Maybe it's a really tight minhag, but it sounds like it's almost a little bit midrabanan. He says, is the re'ah, and he admits himself, the very first Dibur Matchil in the Beit Yosef on Lamed Hey, that if, and you have simanim about this, if a wolf or a weasel or a bird came by, a cat came by and took the lungs before you were able to get to them, or a Mexican guy in a slaughterhouse, I shouldn't say Mexican, a Dominican guy in the slaughterhouse, comes and takes your lungs, so the assumption is, if you didn't get to check them, they're probably kosher. That's one of Rashi's famous, there's two places like this in the entire Shas. Halacha hi ven mefrasamin et hadavar. Just don't tell people they don't have to do it. We should. It's good. It's important. So why did Chazal institute we have to check the reot? Mishum sha sircha mitzuya. Right? Sircha. What does sircha mean in Hebrew? Legion, how'd you get this? Nobody here lanes? When I was little, guys who learned Torah learned how to lane too. Mishnah Mikra, we were careful. It was expected that if you're going to be from, you'd know how to lane. Okay. Im yichut v'ad saruch na'an. V'lo tamar ani ha'asharti et Abraham. Abraham said to who? Mi amar el mi, as they said in second grade. So Abraham aminu to Melech Sedom. Im yichut v'ad saruch na'an. I'm not going to take from you neither a string nor a shoelace, which is a bizarre way of saying I don't want anything from you. Tell him, I'm not going to take an elephant, I'm not going to take a rock. Like, strings and shoelaces is basically the same thing. So siroch na'al, the laces of a boot or a sandal, as they would be back in the day, sircha is not a lesion. That's the whole machloket. A sircha just means a string. Okay, we'll go back to the whiteboard. Explain what this looks like. The animal is on its back, and this is the floor, okay? So the head is over here. Two floppy ears. And the lungs look like this. Here's our famous shipui koha. The lungs look like this. Okay, you have the diaphragm over here. This is the right, that is the left. Do you understand why? Okay, so I'm facing you, this is my right, and this is my left. So the animal's on its back, it's backwards. On the right side, we're going to have that highest lobe of the lung that hits the clavicle, and that determines the Mekom HaShechita, the end of the trachea, as far as we can shecht on it. Okay, this is called Regel Hamor, because it looks like, anybody want to guess? It's kind of blunt, it's roundish looking thing. This one is looks like an arrow, Kachetz, Moshuch. This one is a little bit smaller. And we have two major lobes, one on the right, one on the left. Over here, we only have two lobes of the lung. Okay, so these unot, how do they work? Two places that we say this about animals. One is by the lungs, the other one is by nerves that come out of the lower part of the spine, the lumbar vertebrae. You'll have to see that in the slaughterhouse to understand it. These are called umot, like M. The big, our lungs are the same way, by the way. We also have major and minor lobes to them. One major lobe on either side, three minor on the right, two minor on the left. And on the right side, we also have what's referred to by Chazan as Inunita de Warda. Inunita de Warda, the eye of the rose. It's this tiny little thing. It looks like a rose. It looks like a little mushroom that grows out of nowhere, but it's technically off to the right. It's kind of offset to the right. So, the sircha, a sircha is found. They're common. Rashi says this back then. It wasn't antibiotics. It wasn't GMO feed. It wasn't just animals breathe. They have respiratory issues. Sometimes because it's too hot. Sometimes because it's too cold. Changes in the environment. Parasites can cause this. For the most part. For the most part nowadays. We're pretty good at controlling things like worms. It's not super uncommon. You do find animals that have worms in the nasal cavity and they'll go right to the brain. They don't have fingers in it. They can't groom themselves. These ruminating animals. So their noses are always on the ground. It's easy for these worms or bugs to pop into the nose and just go all the way up. So not a pleasant thing. But it could be that the animal inhales one of these parasites and then it bores a hole through the lungs. More common than not is basically pneumonia. Bronchitis, pneumonia, it's an infection in the lungs. The lungs are very spongy, right? In English, British English, they call them lights in culinary terms. I mean, if you're eating cooked lungs, you're eating lights. They float, they're spongy, they're soft. There are two layers of membrane that encompass the lungs. Basically, only two layers between the air inside the lungs and what's on the other side of them. Pleura. P-L-U-E-R-A. P-L-E-U-R-A, sorry. Pleura. So Chazal recognized this. There are two krumim, okay? And you have this discussion, Tov Mefulash, if you did the Erovin, Nechev Mefulash, if you have a hole, if it was pierced. Straight through both krumim. This would be like maybe a nail or a needle. And animals do something, they'll eat whatever they find. They're not very discriminating. So sometimes they got things. True story of Umberto Piperno, currently the chief rabbi of Milan in Italy, once shechted a cow and found a mechanical alarm clock in the stomach. It still worked. Didn't know how long it was there. He said they checked everything else. It was kosher. They were matzah. They didn't tell anybody what they found there. But it's possible. You know, big cow, small clock, I can see it. So you find different things. Animals are not exceptionally intelligent. If there's a nekev that goes through both of these krumim, the animal is a treifa, right? Not because of how I killed it, because what my kids killed it.
animals are toreifa. Nikav zeh shelo b'fnei shelo keneged zeh. Could be there's a nekev that's like a, not a nekev mefulash. So if the thing holds the air, it's entirely possible it wouldn't be a problem. Show examples of this in the slaughterhouse. So we take the lungs out. We can poke them and play with them. The sirchot are typically caused by infections. Now what happens is like this, because the lungs are full of these little air pockets. The idea is maximizing the surface area where the oxygen can be absorbed through these membranes into the bloodstream, and this is what enriches the blood. Hemoglobin binds oxygen to it, and the muscles use it. So these little airy spaces are very easy to develop bacteria in. They're small, they're moist, they're warm, they're oxygenated. So for aerobic bacteria, it's a bracha. And what happens is that sometimes they'll get infected. And when they get infected, they start to swell. Usually it's white blood cells that rush to these types of areas. And then you have what's called pus. Basically just means the white, mucousy, thick, sticky liquid that comes out. And what happens is like this. If you were looking at, you know, a blown-up picture, what this might look like. So here we have an interruption in the pleura, and the pus, okay, is forcing, there's a pressure that's forcing this up and out. And so, although the membrane wants to heal itself, how's it going to heal itself? Normally, when you have a cut anywhere on your body, right, our skin is full of scars, by the way, you just don't see them. Every time you cut yourself, there's a scar forming. You see, the ones that are visible to the naked eye are actually bigger and thicker. So scar tissue is going to try to form around it, but as long as there's pus pushing, the scar tissue can't occlude. It can't seal itself. It can't close. So what's going to happen is it's going to create basically a very thin tube. Right? Sirchot are always hollow on the inside. They're very thin sometimes, but they're always hollow on the inside because the pressure forces this. And so these adhesions, as they call them, are basically strings that attach the lung, almost always thicker on the lung than they are towards what they're attached to. And basically the scar tissue can only satisfy its urge to bind to something when it hits something else. And so instead of the lung sealing and forming a scar on itself, it'll more often than not bind to the next neighboring lobe of lung. We'll call that the sircha kesidran. If the lungs are adhered one to the other, but you know, consecutive lobes to each other. Often enough, it's a sircha towards the ribs. I had one of these yesterday, where the edge of one of these unot is stuck to the bone or to the membrane, the cartilage between the ribs. It'll stick to the heart, the pericardium, the diaphragm sometimes. Those are usually pretty bad. You find them more commonly towards the front than you do towards the back, which brings me to my next topic of discussion, the whole concept of what we call glatt versus bet Yosef. Okay, I've been politically correct up until now, but the gloves have to come off. What is the makor of the word glatt?
It's a Yiddish word.
So it's a Yiddish word, which really means it's German, right? Because Yiddish is German. And they all told you when you were little that they invented a language that everyone understands. No, it's German. It really is German. Nobody's that clever to invent a whole language like that with irregular verbs. It doesn't happen. So, Yiddish is German. I studied linguistics. So, glatt in German means what? Let's leave what it means in Yiddish for now, because that's what it really means in German. Glatt means smooth. So smooth implies what? Smooth, mashma, there's nothing there. That's why it's smooth, right? Smooth, chalak, Yaakov inu, Esau, right? Nochi ish chalak. I am smooth, I am hairless. There's nothing, like no hairs, no adhesions, nothing on my skin. So, v'hayti be'anau kim ta'atea. Glatt means smooth. It doesn't really mean smooth. It means ke'ilu smooth, as if. Where was the first usage of the term glatt relating to the kashrut of the lungs of mammals? So the very end of the latter half of the 19th century. And these are machlokot, classic machlokot between the Ashkenazim and Sephardim living in Yerushalayim. The glory days, when there were 5 Ashkenazim and 8 Sephardim living in Yerushalayim. Naturally, we had to find what to fight about. Kitniot just wasn't enough. There was like a whole rest of the year that we had to deal with. So the story is like this. The Rama, he writes this. And to be fair, as far as Mekorot are concerned, it starts with the Rambam and moves on to the Tosafot, who probably never saw the Rambam's writings, or at least maybe not until the very end. The Rambam writes like this. The Rambam is living in the 11th, 12th centuries, born in Cordoba in Spain, moved to Morocco
And by the way, he writes very nicely about the Shechita and the Nikur in Eretz HaMa'arav, which no one seems to understand. Maghreb in Arabic is the Arabic word for Morocco. Maghreb just means the West, like Ma'arav in Arabic. So he's living in the country that's called the West by the Muslims, the westernmost country that succeeded in conquering before they conquered France. So it's Ma'arav Maghreb. He's referring to specifically the Jewish communities in Morocco before the expulsion from Spain. Jewish community, the Arabic-speaking community in Morocco, very tight masoret on Nikur and on Shechita, and the Rambam attests this. So, the Rambam writes that he understands this concept of Nikuvat Re'ah 100%. It's a Nevelah. It is a Nikuvat Re'ah, it's a Trefah. Sorry, it's expressly written in the Mishnah. And the Gemara talks about all kinds of different situations with Sirchot. Sounds like it's Asur to eat from an animal that has a Sircha. He writes, Da'ati, my opinion, if you were to ask me, first of all, he writes like this. And the Rashba says the exact same thing. Me'olam lo nipehu re'ah bisfarad. I didn't say it with the Yiddish accent. Me'olam lo nipehu re'ah bisfarad. I was born and raised in Spain. I spent my entire life around Talmidei Chachamim. Never, not once, did anyone ever inflate lungs in Spain. If there was a sircha, we didn't eat it. We sold it to the goyim. No checking, no sense in checking, it wasn't going to help. Their Gemara talks about checking lungs. If you believe the animal inhaled a needle, if it was attacked by a weasel or a leopard or a lion, you might have a suspicion the lungs are pierced. How do you know? You take him out and blow him up. But that's when you have a serious reut. I know exactly what's going on. If they had sirchot, it sounds like they just got rid of the animals. He writes, nonetheless, da'ati is that you can cut shim yachtechem besakin or bezug. If you were to cut these sirchot with a knife or with a pair of scissors, and you didn't find a hole under the sircha, it should be mutar. Right? Except that he writes, me'olam lo ra'iti nohagim ken. Not about to change like a kind of halakha velo lema'aseh. He never did it. He said it was like an interesting thought that he had. Here's the machloket. Here's what he's trying to resolve. Rashi writes, why did Chazal say sirchot are asurot? From the Gemara, simple reading the Gemara, it's got sugis and sugis, but with lamed tet and the daf lamed tet and perkei utrefot and chulin, massive tosafot to see on both sides of the page. So why is a sircha asur? Why is it a problem? According to Rashi, because it's a reuta. You saw something wrong with the lungs. En sircha belo nekev. That's important enough to be written on the board. En sircha belo nekev. Means what? Where there's a sircha, there's a nekev. Where there's smoke, there's fire. So it's not possible that you found the sircha without a hole. You're just not good at identifying holes, that's all. There's a sircha, it means the animal's treif. Go home. Cry it off. Have some apple juice, you feel better tomorrow. The Rabbeinu Tam writes in the Tosafot, really not necessarily so. Yesh sircha belo nekev, ela sha'atid lihot sham nekev. Why did Chazal ask for the sircha? Not because there's a nekev now, because there might be a nekev in the future. They just forgot to tell us that you could take it off and blow it up. But if you do it, it works. It works. You've demonstrated that there is no hole in the lung. That's Rabbeinu Tam, Tosafot, and the rest of the European communities seem to, the Ashkenazi ones anyway, seem to have held from this. There is no mention of this concept of glat. The Rama calls it kasher. In fact, and you have to see this to believe it, Tosafot. Yesh sircha belo nekev, ela she'atid lihiot sham nekev. There's no nekev there now, but very soon there's going to be one. And this is like an Isser Midrabanan, it's a siag. Because Nechubat HaRe'ah is Asura Midoraita, Chazal took one step back, even a Sircha, don't eat from it. Because it's a Safek, and it's a Safek Yisura Midoraita Lechumra. Except, they have all these Kontrasei Sfekot on this topic, speaking of how important Shechita is. You find this referred to everywhere. If there's one Re'uta, if there are two, what if there's a Sircha and it's bleeding, a Sircha and it's discolored, a Sircha and it has these little, feels like stones in there, like these hard infections. The Shach seems to hold this way. Wherever you have two reutot, even that you can check, or maybe that's what the checking is for, depending on how you understand. Anyhow, that's it. So Rashi says, no sircha without a nekev, it's treif, don't even bother. And that's a simple reading of the Gemara. No Sfardim held this way. Rabbi Otam holds, no, you can actually, you can take out the sircha, and you can check. Right? The retort from the Rashi slash Sfardi side was, even if there's no hole, we know for a fact there was a reuta. Kirum shala mehamat makah, eno kirum. So maybe there was a hole. Maybe there is scar tissue that covered it. but the scar tissue formed after the hole. You, my friend, have closed the barn door behind the horses. So now you take off the sircha, there's no hole. I know there's no hole. You took off the scar tissue that formed there. I didn't make up this rule. I didn't make up the klal of krum shalam echamat makah eno krum. That's the Gemara. And that's unanimous. So Rabbeinu Tam holds otherwise. The Rama, if you look in Siman Lamed Hey, it sounds like everything is treif. The Shulchan Aruch talks about a couple of different combinations and permutations. We have to stop when Rav Orlean at 2:30. So he looks at combinations and permutations of different things. We'll talk about two that he was matir. And there's some other discussions by the Rishonim who are struggling with this, but trying to be matir what they can. And the Rama says that if there's a sircha, the enunita de barada, that little lobe that's off to the right, it's a tiny little thing. It's a trefa. And if you have a sircha towards the diaphragm, the tarpash, you have a sircha to krum halev, you have a sircha to the shuman, sircha. The Rama, it sounds like in the Siman Lamed Hey that he's super from, he's machmir, he's matrif, everything that you see. And Siman Lamed Tet, he undoes the entire house of cards and he tells you, but all this is only if you didn't do what's called mishmush, be mashmish. What does it mean to be mashmish? No one knows. All different schools of thought and what this mishmush actually means. The mashmish means to pull it off, it means to peel it off, it means to pull it in a particular direction. Whatever it is, you will not find a book that has any sort of universal standard on what mishmush means because no one actually knows. There are different traditions. This is very much Torah Shabbat Peh. Slaughterhouse technology doesn't develop very quickly, and for some reason a lot of these halachos, a lot of this is also, there's money, there's politics. I hate to say that, being recorded, I'll say it anyway. There's money, there's politics. You won't find too many bodkim who will let you walk into a slaughterhouse and check lungs after them and tell you this were machshir, that were machshir, because they'll be attacked by some other hashgacha. And today, unfortunately, even the gedolim don't go to slaughterhouses. They don't know what lungs look like, and they paskin out of books without actually having much a way of practical experience. That's the emet. That's sort of Yehuda Giat, if you want to quote him. He's the one who was quoted in all the Harot on Sichat Chulin. Paskim today are not Bikim and Shechita. That is what it is. All right. Not in Halacha Lemaise. Simanim and Sifim they've been through. So, the long story short, mark my words on that. There's a lot of Amharatis in this particular industry. So, the Machloket went and developed. The Rama writes, and he writes very apologetically. This is what I would have told you last night if I had the time. I was tied up. I got bed very late. Read it before next week. Siman Lamed Tet. The Rama's massive apology for this this kula. He writes, "Bimdinot elu, we have this minhag. Even though I told you about 300 times that everything is treif, if you the minhag in this area, bimdinot elu, is to be mimashmesh and lenapeach. And if you can ascertain or verify this way that there's no hole, we don't require anything else, and in the end, it's all kosher if it doesn't bubble or whistle or make any other sound that leads you to believe that there was a nekev under the sircha that you just took off, and even this." And he says this dragging his feet. You can read right into his word. You know he's not happy about it. He says, "En la'asot ken bigdayim utlayim va'agalim arrakim." Don't do this with little animals. If they're that sick, they're just going to die anyway, and like, why take the chance? He's not happy about it. He writes it and he's not happy about it. But it is what it is. So he holds this way. You shouldn't do it with young animals. Today, everybody does it with young animals too, because they all hold it. It's an ikaradin kind of thing. Look, hefsed merubeh. It is what it is. Either there's a hole or there's not. I don't know what it would have been like in a year. I just killed it now. I don't need it to live another year. If it's kosher now, we can eat it. If it's not, we can't. So Sfaradim Ashkenazim ended up in Yerushalayim. This is, you have Adat HaPurushim. Back then, the Groz Talmidim came to Israel in 1800, 1801. And you had Sephardim from different communities who lived closer and had an easier time getting out of Yerushalayim, at least for periods. Some of them stuck it out. So what happened was, these machlokot developed. What were the machlokot about? So the sirchot, classically. And there's a little bit of what some perceive to be an Ashkenazi chumra versus a Sephardi kula. That's not an uncommon thing. It's just not necessarily proven that this is the case, but I'll explain. The Beit Yosef, and you've heard the term Beit Yosef when it comes to lungs? Because the Beit Yosef is checking them for me, right? In case it wasn't. Right. The Beit Yosef mentions a name of some of the Rishonim that there are two kinds of sirchas that he's not here in the Chatzila. Rishonim held this way. What are the sirchas that he accepts? One is a sircha kesidran,
Okay? And that's typically defined as the length of the lobe divided by 2. Okay? If they're attached to each other, from this point and on, that kind of sircha, he holds, you get away with this like Hainu Ravi Taihu kind of concept. It's like, it's the way they grow. If you see undeveloped lungs, especially in younger animals, this is why it's important. If you want to understand Shechita, especially Dika, you have to check different animals from different of different ages and different sizes. The lungs start pretty much attached. And these lobes get defined over time. And Chazal knows this, and we showed him this too. So these definitions become clearer as the animal gets older until these lobes have actually separated and not fleshed out. Right? And when they're younger, it's very hard sometimes to tell them apart. Really small animals, what you might have is a sedic. You might have like a crease in between them, not like a full-blown separate lung. So Hanu Ravi Taihu, they grow connected, they detach over time. Leave it. As long as it's on the ventral side, the side facing the stomach, meaning we don't like these sirchot if they're on the back. The back of the lungs is a problematic area. If it's from the back of the lungs to the ribs, it's a big problem. But if it's on the interior side, the ventral side, facing the animal's stomach, not the spine, up until half of the extension of the lobe, potentially further, but that's generally how we hold today. The other kind of sircha that the Shulchan Aruch holds from, so let me just write this down, that's called a sircha. Sircha, oh well. Kesidran, right? Kesidran, it's like lefi haseder, ala seder. Because they're consecutive lobes, it's not that big a deal. That's how they grow. They don't grow lobe 3 to lobe 1. They would never. There's no good reason for them to be attached. That would be a trefa, but otherwise, it'd work out. The other possibility he leaves you, okay? And these are really two. The other possibilities he gives you, what's called a... Sorry, I'm a little bit tired. Sircha. Ledofen tsar. Sircha ledofen tsar. Sorry. What does dofen mean in Hebrew?
Well,
dofen could technically mean a wall, relatively small one generally. It's not a kotel, it's a dofen. What does tsera mean in Hebrew? Right, so this is the famous Christian interpretation. Tzera means like tzera hamishkan temana. It's a side. It's a whole series of ribs, like a side of beef maybe. Adam and Chawa are born conjoint and then separated. It doesn't mean rib. Dofen is the word used by the Mishnah for ribs. So if an animal had a certain number of broken ribs, or if the ribs are broken at the vertebrae, that could potentially be a trefa. But the expression for that is dofen. Dofen or defanot. Sircha le dofen tzar, okay, looking at the animals from a side view, say like a cross section. So average animal, the ruminant, would look like this. In a fat lamb. So, the rib cage, if you were to take off the wool and the skin and the fat, etc., the rib cage looks like this. And then the ribs get long. They go from the spine all the way down. So the ribs actually make a shape like this. The first 5 ribs, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, out of a total of how many? 13. 13 ribs. Total, except for buffalo. European buffalo, I think, have 14 ribs, and the American one is 15, or the other way around, but yeah. Anomaly in the rib world. The first five ribs are what they call dofen tsar. They're just short ribs, not butcher term short ribs. The short ribs would actually come from here. In terms of short ribs, meaning ribs that aren't very long, tsar means narrow. So we're talking about there's a very tight space at the end of the neck. When I told you how the lungs can't possibly force out of the clavicle if they wanted to. So the space here is very tight. All right? And the logic behind the Rishonim that the Shulchan Aruch quote, the Beit Yosef, to be fair, quotes, is that the place is very tight. Anyway, there's a serious machloket Rishonim as to the nature of the sircha with a nekev, without a nekev. Here the space is so tight that even if there was a sircha, it wouldn't cause a problem, wouldn't be a terefa. It's a logic put forth by a number of Rishonim, and that Quran became very popular. These two kinds of sirchot, the Shulchan Aruch is machshir lechatachila. Does it give you any headaches, give any problems? He doesn't demand glot. talk about glatt in a second, but he doesn't demand chalak, for example, which chalak in Hebrew actually means smooth. It doesn't mean it anymore, but it used to. It's kind of like glatt. So he doesn't require any more than, if you do have sirchot, just make it one of these two kinds. No mishmush and no nipuach. So the Ramah comes back and he says, no. He didn't respond to the Beit Yosef because he was after him. But his response to this, his retort would be, and the Poskim go in his derech, is, wait a second. We the Ashkenazim, yes, it's true that we're super mekilim. I mean, really mekilim when it comes to lungs, because Beit Yosef accounts for anywhere between 5, maybe 10%, want to stretch it 15, of large-scale industrial shechita of cattle. And glatt, you're pushing about 60%. 14, 15, 60 on a good run. That's a lot. That's a massive, massive difference. So they hold, yes, it's true that we do mishmush and nipuach, and okay, right, most of the Rishonim, we're not crazy about this. But at the same time, the minhag has been to be menapeach, all lungs that come our way. As if to say, the sirchot that most of the Rishonim agreed were fine anyway, we're so machmir to require you to inflate them. And here you could potentially find the kula of the Sephardim, the Beit Yosef, versus the Ashkenazim, in that the Shulchan Aruch doesn't care how thick the sircha is, if it's kesidran, or if it's the dofen sar. He's indifferent. It could be a very thick sircha, it could be so thick, I know it's going to bubble or whistle when I take it off and blow it up. And so the Sephardi response would be, don't do it. There is no good reason to do this. You'll be guilty of what's called being marbet refot b'Israel. Why would you blow up the lungs if they're kosher anyway? And the Rishonim held this way, and they hold this way without bdika. It's a minhag by the Ashkenazim to be menafeach, and this minhag, for it to come and say, ah, I know that you think this is kosher anyway, but a minhag to be more machmir, then the Rishonim hold this as mutter anyway. And that's where you have the potential for, in the great wide world of lung checking, one massive Ashkenazi kula versus the Sephardim who are very machmir, except in this particular case where, if it's a thick sircha, it could potentially be that it would make problems when you blow it up, but the Rishonim knew this and didn't care. Then the shaila becomes, what happens if you did take it off and you did blow it up? Do we hold by, we don't care because the Rishonim are machmir and didn't need this nipuach? Or have you actually proven that this now is a problem, even though it was still a suffix before you did it? The Maaseh, in large-scale industry today, the Sephardim would either blow such a thing up or not even take it to begin with, but it still accounts for a very small minority of animals relative to the glatt inclusion, which is anywhere from 5 to 10 times more inclusive than the Beit Yosef. Yeah?
Could you please clarify that again, the difference between glatt and the Beit Yosef? You said it wasn't 5 times more than 6 times.
I didn't yet, so don't feel bad if you didn't understand. How these machlokot, I had to give you that was like the fodder for the fight. So how the machlokot develop? Because when Jews live together in communities, they manufacture crises. We know this. You all go to shul. So the Ashkenazim and Sephardim living in Yerushalayim, everybody's dirt poor. Okay, nobody was living in the lap of luxury. Maybe you had some Italians. Everybody was poor, Montefiore. So inevitably, they'd be shechting. How do you shecht a behema when you have no refrigeration outside? You shecht fast, and you find people to split the animal with you. So if I'm shechting a goat or a lamb, chicken I can probably take by myself. I mean, I have a family. Shechting a goat or a lamb, there's a significant amount of meat. I mean, you want to split it up. So, Abraham Mizrahi says to Yankel Rosenbaum, come, why don't we split this carcass? We'll go b'michsat nefashot, like Korban Pesach. And you eat in your house and I'll eat in mine. So he says, okay, fine, go ahead. Who's shechting? It's me or you. Go ahead, you shech this time. I'm tired. So he shechs. How are the lungs? The lungs were great. Baruch Hashem. No, I've done a little bit of reading and I understand. Ashkenazim and Sephardim, some of the differences when it comes to lungs. Kasher. Kasher is kasher. Ah, but it was kasher with sirchot or without sirchot. Kasher, trust me. It's okay. Sharet nicht. It doesn't cause any damage. It's okay. So these discussions started to get a little bit heated. Wait a second. What you call kasher actually had sirchot. Aye, but we took them apart. We blew them up. But we don't hold from taking apart and blowing up. Tov, don't worry. Now it's glatt. This glatt, it's so smooth that the sircha is like it wasn't even there. How do you know? Because I took it off and blew it up and it wasn't there. It's fine. Everything is perfect. You can eat from it.
And Sfaradim came back and said, okay, we should call this Beit Yosef. Aye, but the Beit Yosef, you see, there were two things he was matir in the Chatchila. Two other things he was matir with the Avad. You'll see this in Siman Lamed Hei and Lamed Tet. What was he matir with the Avad? One, right out of the mouths of the Rishonim, like everything else in the Beit Yosef, very little is actually, he says, Laniu Dati, it's more, he's quoting Rishonim. What happens if there was a sircha that the tabach stuck? The tabach means a shochet. It doesn't mean a cook today, right? In modern Hebrew, a tabach is a cook. You know how to cook meat, you know how to cook anything, but tabach literally means a shochet. So the tabach, hechnis et yado, maybe with a little bit of koach, you know? Jabbed his hands in there, and if there was a sircha there, it's gone. It's not there anymore. So, okay, so what happened, kind of, bishgaga, kind of, not so much, but it is what it is, and you can't find it afterwards, you don't have to blow it up, it's okay. Yesh machshirim. That's not kasher, that's yesh machshirim. There's a difference. Another example of this he gives is a sircha bat yoma. What's a sircha bat yoma? It's a sircha that's so small and so loose and so light that it must have formed just yesterday. I mean, tiny little things, so it's not even a big deal. So even if you find one of those things in a place where there could be potential for a big deal, but it's so light that you move it, you know, it's different, that later different mehagim developed. Like if you take the lungs and you shake them and it separates by itself, it's okay, Mishnah Gemara don't talk like this. So that he also says, yesh machshirim, there are those who hold from it and those who don't. So Mr. Mizrahi says back to Mr. Rosenbaum, no. Where are we with this whole glad chalak situation? Oh, well, first it was kasher, you didn't like that. And then I said, okay, it's Beit Yosef. But when you said Beit Yosef, it's Beit Yosef chadchara b'diavad, meaning it's sircha l'dofen tsar, or sircha kesidran, or it's actually one of these, shoved my hands in, tried to rip something by accident, on purpose. Look in Simen Lamed Hei and Lamed Tet, and Maran says it twice, the Shulchan Aruch says it twice. This concept of being memashmesh and menapeach, taking off the sirchot and blowing them up, I'm quoting him. He's doche b'shtei adayim, and he says, karov hadavar shema'achilim terefot unvelot atzibur. Look it up. He didn't say it once, he said it twice. He was extremely adamant about this minhag not being acceptable. Ashkenazim held differently. So the discussion went back and forth. First it was kasher, aye, but you have sircha. So yeah, but we blew them up. Aye, we don't hold that way. Well, but you have sircha that you do accept. Yeah, but even then we don't blow them up. Well, sometimes we blow them up. Okay. Where do we end up? Mr. Mizrahi said back to Mr. Rosenbaum, do me a favor. I want it smooth. Glat. No, not glat like you took it off and blew it up. Glat like halak. Where halak means halak. With a kuf. Halak. So, not a problem. Now you want to hold that it has to be perfectly smooth. It's extremely machmir. It's very difficult to find. There are plenty of animals that are healthy and could live a long life that aren't necessarily halak. But it is what it is. Just so you don't make any mistakes, Sfardim sold out too. In the modern era of industrial shechita, what they call halak is really Beit Yosef lechatechila. What they call Beit Yosef is Beit Yosef b'diaba. Just putting that out there. I am about to do some shimush with Rav Mahfud and his the one who's in charge of Shechita and Nikur by him. I'm going into it totally naive. I know nothing. Show me what you do, because that's been my experience with all these highfalutin bodkin that come from Eretz Yisrael. At the end of the day, it's a business. There's money. Hefsed merube. There's Rishonim. Yesh l'mashi yismochu. And Kedai hu Rabbi Shimon. So everybody runs towards the coolest they can find, whatever is within reason. So if you go to a supermarket today, I've been in slaughterhouses, there are plenty of places in the country where they have started anyway to keep track of what comes out so-called halak, what comes out so-called Beit Yosef or glat or not. At the end of the day, what they mean by halak is not perfectly smooth, right? It's just that it's Beit Yosef lechatchila. So whoever calls it chalak and pronounces it properly, with a chet and with a kuf, would eat from it lechatchila, because Beit Yosef didn't require chalak. They required it with Beit Yosef lechatchila, because Beit Yosef is Beit Yosef. And if it's called Beit Yosef, it's Beit Yosef b'diavad. Like, this could pass in the eyes of the Beit Yosef, even though he might not have passed it. Whatever. Guys, we do what we can. So glat is a discussion. What's the difference between glat and non-glat? This one takes guts. Glat and not glat, what's the difference? There is no difference. It's a trade name, right? It's a trade name. It's a terminus technicus, that's all it is. The Ramah doesn't use the term glat because he doesn't care, because it's kasher, because he holds like the Rabbeinu Tam and the Rambam and the rest of the Ashkenazi, later Ashkenazi Rishonim, who accepted this practice there is no inherent difference between glat and non-glat. What you have is different hashgachot or different Hasidic groups that hold. Our Rebbe said that we shouldn't be machshir more than three sirchas. Why? Who said this? The Rama didn't hold it for the Turma. Din prutak din ma'a. You have one, you have 100. As long as you took them all apart and you blew them up, it's fine. Who made these arbitrary or random decisions that this should be called glat and we're more glat than you because you are only eating kasher? You're eating Rama. You're all eating Rama. No offense. Yeshamashi smuchu. Again, who am I to say? But still, don't sell it as something more than it is. You all rely on the same kulas. Why are you making it as if you're more exclusive than him? Okay? We're still on record, Rabotai. I sell meat to Rebbeim at the OU. Not under the OU, but at the OU. Okay? I've done shemesh with lots of different characters from different hashgachas in different places. The world of kashrus is a fascinating and an interesting one. Getting people to commit to you in an email, in writing, or on a video, what they pass as glat and what they pass as not is impossible. It's impossible. There's a degree of transparency that just doesn't exist anymore in this tchum, where people will say things off the record. They might show you something, and you're not allowed to take out your camera or your cell phone. You can't photograph. You can't. Why? Because there are billions of dollars at stake. Because if the word gets out that this hashgacha or that one is more machmir, more mekil, or more reliable, more competent, or not, it is what it is. At the end of the day, the Rama holds from the Rambam and Rabbeinu Tam. Those are pretty broad shoulders. So you know at least what you're relying upon if you hold that way, which is fine. Beit Yosef was very adamant. You don't find too many places where he's mamish adamant. He's adamant. He's adamant. He wasn't shy about letting you know. And he said it twice in two different simanim. Beseder. So what passes today for Beit Yosef isn't even what it sounds like he passed himself l'chadchila. Just putting it out there. Slaughterhouse is one of the beautiful areas where halacha meets ma'aseh, where money meets more than one different kind of taiva, the taiva for meat, the taiva for money, the taiva for both. It's funny to see what happens to halacha in places like this, but this is where the rubber meets the road. Yeah?
So a question based, Yosef, if I shech an animal, what's the chance that the lungs will not make the trade?
My friend.
You said 7 to 15, was that the...
How much does a car cost? Depends on the car, depends on the make, depends on the model, depends on the demand, depends on...
My question is...
You're asking me what? You're asking me about a baby lamb or about a retired dairy cow, about a mountain goat?
You gave a statistic before, it was just 7 to 15%, I think. Is that out of context?
In the context of what we call commodity beef, so animals that are raised for meat and not for milk, what generally ranks as, let's say, USDA choice is a good target. The USDA has a grading system based on fat. Did we talk about fat?
Yeah.
What makes an animal prime or choice? It's about the distribution of the fat. More fat, and fat in the muscle, the intramuscular fat, intermuscular fat, because even the USDA knows that fat tastes good. So prime steak is just fattier than a choice one, choice is fattier than select, etc. So when we say commodity beef, usually we're aiming for choice, which is good steaks. So in the USDA choice market, you're looking at, and I guess it's going to depend on how you define things, right? So you ask me what comes out, like halak?
Something that the Beis Yosef thinks you need, not eating a trefa.
Not eating a trefa, so we're going to assume, let's say, like Beit Yosef B'diavad. Maybe 15%.
So then why, in the case of...
I've heard people claim as high as 20, but the guy lost his job. I don't know why. No, it wasn't related. I know why he lost his job. I don't know if that's had to... I mean...
So then, in cases of Abdu Haveya, so then why are we making... If Abdu Haveya, you're telling me there's an 80% chance that I'm eating the trade.
According to the Beit Yosef. But you hold back the Ramah, so what's the big deal?
Okay.
Guys, great Facebook quote from this past week. Dear colleague and friend of mine, Rabbi Yoshua Ma'aruf, you heard all this to-do about the kosher switch?
Yes.
Okay. Oh, Rabbi Chaim holds from it. So basically, it's like the Rav Doivert and the Shemach Bat Kilchata about moving the pins on a Shabbos clock, which
yeah.
You can do. It's not a big deal. It's electricity, which is Midoraita, right? Because the Torah says don't use electricity. No, I was just kidding. Or I wasn't. So... So Rav Maruf writes like this, without taking sides, there's a tremendous amount of uproar, the selective outrage is like the new thing, the hashtag selective outrage, over the kosher switch and its admissibility on Shabbat, and whether it's actually circumventing the halachot or the ruach of the Shabbat, etc. Where's the outrage over the kosher string? Which is this concept of Surat HaPetach that renders hundreds of Dafim of Gemara and Mishnah obsolete. Even though the Rif and the Rambam and the Beit Yosef hold that there's no such thing as Tiltul being Drabanan today. I mean, no indication from the Gemara. So the Rosh holds this way, fine, no offense. You hold like you hold, I hold like I hold.
Yeah.
So you're asking me, is it possible the Rishonim have big machlokot?
And asking, if I come to your slaughterhouse, steal the lugs out of the cow, and from what you're saying, there's an 80% chance that you can't eat that. 85. That according to you, that's trade for chayit, not to say chayit makas, because I don't know if this is still on it, but you can't eat it. But as soon as I steal the lungs, you can eat it.
Politely decline.
So, I'm just wondering.
Are you trying to get me to say something fiery and polemical? Like,
no.
How do you
explain
it?
How
do
you?
I'm sorry. That's Rabbi Chaim. He said that the glut meat in the cafeteria, for example, on Shabbos, we don't really have much of a choice. I can not eat it. But he said that I can be so inclined to say give me talareya, assuming that if it's glut, that's what he told me. So you can assume that's also okay for a story.
So, it's a bit delicate. Rav Ovadia Yosef sounded off on this. Assuming, right? And by the way, you should know all the best kontrasens pekot were written on this topic of the re'ah. I mean, again, the shote, definition of a shote, for gittin, for kiddushin, for shtarot, for edut, nemanut, mumar lachis, mumar tevon. This is all the first few blot of chulin. It's like all these juicy halachic discussions about people and their different incompetencies are all here. Assuming that we can call a suffix something that we can't resolve. You ever been through the kontrasens pekot? It's delicious.
Yeah.
Absolutely delicious. Is it a safek mechamat chasroni di'ah? Do you just not know halacha? So if I'm an am haaretz, I have the zechut of having a safek deraita everywhere. Like I can't be over anything with deraita. I don't know what deraita is. So I got to get out of Gehenim free card because I'm an am haaretz. So you don't know, but someone else does. I shechted with one of two knives. I know which one it was. You know, you don't. So one of them had a pegima, one of them didn't. So for you it's a safek, and for me it's not. So did you still call it a safek? You're asking me a question that's hard to answer. Would the Beit Yosef eat from these lungs that were taken away? I don't know. You're asking me a question. I mean, it sounds like it wouldn't. If I'm in a slaughterhouse, okay, and someone was machshir the lungs and I don't know why or under what premise, maybe it was chalak, maybe it was glat, maybe it was Beit Yosef, maybe it was kasher, which, you know, not that big a difference. Probably it wasn't a trefa according to everyone. In such a situation, where Beit Yosef v'mala could be mitzaref, like a chazel etzterufe, I might have some kind of a safek where I can say, okay, first of all, it's a safek whether or not it's a chabalonekiv, yesh chabalonekiv. Second of all, maybe the meat that I have in front of me would have been Beit Yosef anyway, and I can make a safek sfeka out of what's, you know, a machloket, a midoreta, etc. Fine. So I want to hold that way. And I want to make life, you know, feasible and possible. If there are slaughterhouses that are, let's say, makpidim, because they have a monetary incentive to segregate the Beit Yosef product from the non-Beit Yosef product, that makes that speka very hard to hold from.
Well, what is
the Messias? In other words, the Messias is like this. They get more money for Beit Yosef because it's harder to find. And they're always sold out of it. So they don't leave it there for the sake of mixing it with glat in order to be matir things for Sfarad. You know, like, it's not how the industry works. So I want to say, fine, maybe we have some Beit Yosef b'di'avad situations that might have passed. I don't know. I don't know. Rabbi Ben Chaim is a much greater Tamid Chacham. I'm not going to call myself a Tamid Chacham to say that I can compare. He's a Tamid Chacham, and I'm not. He knows halacha, he knows fekot, he's been through all these things. And he knows shechita too, by the way. It's very rare. For Tamid Chacham, he's a super baki in Bdikat HaRe'ah. And it's true that in different periods of history, and this is also an important bit of information not to be ignored, both in parts of Morocco, though much to the disdain of other parts of it, but in parts of Morocco and in some communities in Tunisia, and this was the case in much of Yemen, they eventually came, at least Kehorat Sha'ah, to hold like the Re'ah. This was for varying reasons. In Tehran, for example, where to this day they're still fighting the Shia and the Sunni. So there's this thing. They decided they're not eating from the kosher shechita anymore. Right? The Quran says specifically, so this is like a Muslim midoraita, that you're allowed to eat from the meat of what they call Ahl Kitab, like the Ohel, like the nation of the book, of the Ketuv, like the people of the book, which most Muslims have interpreted to mean the Jews. Some included the Christians and some didn't. And then as time went on, these rifts got bigger, so some of the Muslims decided, came up with the Chiddush, we shouldn't be eating from the Shechita of Jews. And there came up with different reasons for it. So if the Goyim weren't buying the Trefot or Nevelot from the Jews, kosher meat became very expensive, and Trefot and Nevelot became unaffordable. Okay? So there would be no kosher meat. Okay, so they found the Rishonim, and they were some Mechanis. Why? You didn't have during the Crusades communities that lifted the Chaim Darabenu Gershom, where they could engage a girl to, you know, a guy to more than one woman, just to say, at least for the 1 in 100 crusaders that cared if she was married or not, so they wouldn't take her away. So, Baruch Hashem, they were selmich on each other. Mizrahi and Rosenbaum can get along, just sometimes we have to be a little halachically creative. So so you have such a thing. I don't want to hold you guys too long, you probably have other things to do. Be'ezrat Hashem, Baruch, we said to Rav Orlian
next week.
At the same time.
We'll try to get there at 12:30.
Yeah, earlier is better.
So let's, we're going to meet.